think it was, when Khrushchev was here. Was that the year?
No, 60.
60. Anyway, he said Khrushchev hugged him and so on. But I think it was at a later point. I've forgotten now at what point. But he he thought. And then we had a visit from Kuznetsov, who was an important Russian whom we knew well. And he was rather friendly. And I remember Dodd coming out from a meeting, and nobody was there except the two of them, saying, it's okay. They're not going to make a great thing of this, or something like that. And that, of course, was not... It was not borne out, you see. They did hit him very hard. And even though he tried to rally the Third World people, he did not do it, in my judgment, on the level that was required. He thought by getting votes here in the General Assembly and speeches that that would be...
sufficient.
Yeah, and instead he should have... He should have really, in my judgment, gotten people like Nehru or whoever else
Tito, people to have
intervened with both sides. And he probably did not do enough with the Americans. There wasn't that much good communication there either. So there it was. He was interested in detail, and he was very good on, certainly for me, fascinating on these legal issues, and no other Secretary General had anything like that interest.
Now, how do you feel, of course, Utan took over in October of 61 as acting Secretary General. What do you think about his performance in connection with the Congo?
Well, I didn't feel as close to him on these things. I knew him. Hammarskjöld had used him in the earlier stages to rally delegates, and I got to know him in that connection on the Congo issue. I think he did pretty well, and by that time the tide had moved toward helping the central government, and he followed along. He met the popular demand to help to put down the revolts
resolutions and the Security Council and so on, and then the assembly sort of changed over the years.
Yeah, they moved in that direction, and there was this general support for acting against any secessionist movements and the like, and there was a hard choice there, and Uthant, I think, handled that quite well. He was less interested in the law. He was more interested in the aim of unity. He had a strong personal antipathy towards secession because of Burma's problems, and he often expressed, not often, but occasionally, he made press statements which were unfortunate from my point of view in his position that was so strongly Unitarian, whereas from my point of view and Hammarskjöld's point of view, these questions of internal organization of a state and whether autonomy should be given to Shens or whoever they might be was not UN's business at all. They were the business of the people concerned. And Uthant had a very strong feeling of that kind, which he could express in the Congo situation and in other cases.
Well, that's been very helpful in clarifying then. There's one or two other questions I'd like to put to you if we have the time. And one thing, you were you were involved in the negotiations in 1947 on the headquarters agreement, mm-hmm, between the U.S. and the U.N.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this has become a focus of attention in the news just now, mm-hmm. and we're speaking in March 1986, mm-hmm. since the U.S. has decided mm-hmm. to force the Soviet mission to the U.N. to reduce the number of its staff.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about the legality of that U.S. order?
Well, I don't know whether it was an order, because I haven't seen it, but I think the principle, the agreement, is not unclear on this point. I noticed in the newspaper that a number of people who are labeled as experts have said the agreement is vague or doesn't deal with the problem. That's not true. I don't think they read the agreement. The agreement says that resident staffs must be agreed upon by the United States, the Secretary General, and the member government concerned. Now, it seems to me that no government has a unilateral right to bring in as many people as it feels like for a mission. If, for example, a government said, we have too many people in our city, I want to bring 5,000 people to be part of our mission, that would be excessive. The U.S. certainly would have a right to claim that that's not in accordance with the aims of the headquarters agreement. So therefore, there's nothing illegal about the U.S. making its position clear. The member government, as I say, does not have a unilateral right. But neither does the U.S. have a unilateral right, nor does the U.N. The point is that all three are required to reach agreement. In a situation like this, the agreement contemplates, the headquarters agreement contemplates, that there will be agreement. If there is no agreement, then it also contemplates that there could be, if negotiation fails, there should be, must be, submission to an arbitration, a three-member arbitration, and that would be the final decision. So the U.S., I think, has a right to raise the point. I don't know the merits, the numbers that are involved. The Soviet Union has a right to object. The Secretary General has a duty to try to reach agreement. And as I say, if agreement cannot be reached, there's a way of settling it. All of this was contemplated at the time.
I was going to say, did this come up at the time of the draft?
Well, we didn't, as I recall. I can't recall that we considered numbers, because nobody thought of the missions as being enormous in size. But the idea that the three parties concerned would have to agree as to staff and so on was there, was understood, was written in. The U.S. security concerns weren't addressed so much to numbers as such, but they were certainly brought up over and over again. And in the end, the Congress, in approving the treaty, did put in a provision that it should not diminish, impair, or reduce the national security of the United States. And then the Secretary General had the problem of whether to consider that a reservation, an exception to the treaty. If he did that, he would have to go back to the General Assembly for its approval. So we decided, legally, and the Secretary General decided, that this was not a reservation. In other words, that means that it was understood that the U.S. has legitimately a security concern, in the national security concern in the matter, and that would be recognized. So I see no basic illegality. Of course, to emphasize, if the U.S. treats this as an order, as though it must be followed at their unilateral request, that is not permissible. And I think that the procedure I indicated was what we contemplated at the time.
And the Pereira de Cuellar would play a key role in that.
Yes. Now, it's up to him. We had this kind of problem over the years in other situations. We had disputes with the U.S. in several cases when I was involved. And there's always a question for the Secretary General as whether he should pass this question on to the other organs of the UN, notably the Assembly or some committee, or whether he should act for the United Nations. Under the agreement, in the end, the dispute that goes to the arbitration must be between the United Nations and the United States, not between a government and the United States. So the United Nations must then adopt a position which would be contrary to the U.S. position. And whether the Secretary General would wish to do that on his own or refer to the organization, I think depends on the gravity of the issue. On a technical issue like Glen Cove taxation or something like that, which we
that,
had.
That is the Soviet mission to the UN.
In Glen Cove,
yes.
Yeah. That's a technical point, and there was, didn't seem much sense going to the General Assembly. But on an issue of this kind, if I were the Secretary General, I would consult the membership in one form or another through a committee, as I think he's doing, or if in the end the Assembly, rather than handle this entirely on my own responsibility.
Now, I wanted to, we have discussed Hammarskjöld at some length, and in particular you were talking about crisis management. Now, I'd like to do the same thing in connection with two other Secretaries General that you worked with. First of all, with Trygve Lie. Mm-hmm. What would you say was his greatest strength?
Well, he was a... his greatest strength was probably a kind of common touch that he had, sort of common sense feeling. He was not an intellectual. He didn't have any of the kind of interests in doctrine that Hammarskjöld had, and he played things pretty much by ear, and he sort of was responsive to governments. And perhaps his greatest strength at that early stage was the impression he gave of being an honest, straight-shooting person. I don't think this was in fact the case, but I think that that impression was a strong one, and I think that in the early years he was probably a good symbol for the UN.
What would you say would probably then his greatest weakness?
Well, I don't think he was a strong man in the sense that he was easily pushed by what he thought were stronger forces. And while, as I say, in a way this represents a strength, the other side represents the weakness. And I think that his conduct at the time of the U.S. investigations of personnel was duplicitous. That is to say, he kind of tried to encourage the U.S. and yet tried to present the opposite picture. He tried to work both sides of the street too much in those cases. He also was an impulsive man and frequently took decisions that were very quickly taken. But he had engaging qualities, and it's hard to, I don't mean to condemn him. I think he had strengths and weaknesses. He had a demagogic tendency.
Now, during his years, there were a number of crises, and I'm thinking particularly, for example, of the 48 Middle East War and then 50 the Korean War. How was he in crisis management? We've talked about Hammarskjöld,
uh-huh.
and his role, particularly in the Congo. But what about Lee? Was he a good crisis manager?
Well, he didn't really face the problems seriously because the Korean War was simply carried on by the U.S. He participated, of course, in it. He followed the U.S. line. Politically, he kind of shifted. He was courageous, in a sense, and I think in coming out in an elaborate way on the basis of a memorandum which we in the legal office wrote in favor of representation of the People's Government of China. And that was contrary to, at that point, to the U.S. position. He also had somewhat good program, a 10-point program, which he came back with. And at that stage, I think he was on the line of being a leader. Then, unfortunately, the Korean War came, and he felt, and I think perhaps rightly, that the UN should be on the side there. And that, of course, destroyed his position as a position with a large part of the membership. I don't think he... I can't say much about crisis management. I think on a lot of issues, he let the organization, apart from the issues he was directly concerned with, which involved personnel to some degree, particular crises of that kind, he didn't pay much attention to the organization otherwise, and therefore, in a way, that wasn't too bad. He was not a block. When Hammarskjöld came in contrast, he started reading the reports of the Economic Department and serious reports. He called up people from different sections and asked them about their detailed work, whereas Trygve Lie, of course, had no knowledge of these fields at all. The only area I ever recall that he had any specific interest of a detailed kind was he had a curious interest in employees' compensation. And the because he had, for most of his career, been a specialist in workmen's compensation in Norway. And you can see how different his background was from the ordinary diplomat's background.
I remember once, Oscar, when you were saying about his lack of interest. It was at Lake Success, and it was fairly early in the evening. It might have been 7:30 or 8 o'clock. The Security Council was meeting. And I think he felt he had to go back to his office for a few minutes. And I was following him down the corridor. And suddenly he stopped because he could hear a noise in an adjoining room. And he went and opened the door, and it was the mimeograph room. And he looked around in amazement and said to nobody in particular, "Good God, what is this?"
Yes, he was an impulsive man, and he was very close. I remember one occasion. I don't know if this is known, and with the I happened to be present at the very beginning in Hunter College. Our room, I shared a room with Abe Feller. We had a big room, and I had a desk in the same room as he did. It was a classroom. It was next door, well, practically next door to Trygve Lie's room. So we saw a lot of Trygve Lie because he would come into our room very often. Or we would go into his room. Things were very informal. In the very beginning, I remember when he had word that the British had declined to put forward the British Assistant Secretary General candidate whom he wanted, named Williams. I forgot his first name.
Francis Williams.
He was the
editor of the Labour Party newspaper.
That's right. And he wanted and had expected Francis Williams, and he received word that Francis Williams was not to be coming.
He wanted to make him Assistant Secretary General.
That's right,
for
public information. And he was... typically, Lee, I remember him in several such occasions, he blew his top, And he said immediately, David, to David Owen, who was his assistant, who was the executive assistant, I don't know if he was called that at the point, you will be my British Assistant Secretary General. And David said, okay, he said something, thank you or something, but who will take my job? So Lee looked around the room and he said, Cordier, you will take his job. Now, Cordier was David's assistant. And then Cordier became the executive assistant, and David, of course, would say economics, and then they moved on. This was very early. And then I remember being involved with Cordier, one of the most interesting things, which was showed how I couldn't understand the significance of it, but I used to go to meetings about the General Assembly and how it would be organized, and Cordier and Pelt were the main people, but Cordier started...
That was Adrian Pelt, the Dutchman.
Yes, and Cordier started... Pelt thought he was in charge of the assembly, but Cordier, of course, didn't accept that. And then Cordier had the idea that, which nobody had thought of, because it had not been done, that... a rostrum should be built with three seats. That was not the case in the League of Nations. Why three seats? And, of course, the answer was clear. The third seat would be Cordier, not Pelt. There was Trygve, Spock, and Cordier. And I remember saying to an Abe Feller, who was very perceptive, said, that's a very important decision. And I said, no, what? It's a bit of carpentry. Why is Cordier so interested? And he said, oh, no, you don't understand this. Cordier will be sitting there, and symbolically, he will then become the, although in rank, you see, he was not an assistant secretary general. But by putting himself with that, I remember I said, well, they're three fat men, Lee, Spock, and Cordier, and they will all look alike. And I remember fella saying, don't underestimate. This shows that you accused me of underestimating Cordier, who was not a very articulate person, and I therefore tended to not to treat him. I mean, the other people were much more articulate and knew the business. Andy had no background in international organization at all. And Feller said to me, you've underestimated him greatly, and this act of his, of building this rostrum, will turn out to be very significant. And Feller was completely right, because this gave that otherwise obscure post, what might have been an obscure post, unusual significance, and Andy later took over the assembly from Pelt and became the sort of number two man in the public perception, although the other assistant secretary general never accepted that. And then there was the question, then Trygve Lie wanted to bring in a deputy, and he offered that
Sir Robert Jackson.
No, Jackson wanted to be the deputy, but the others wouldn't have him. Jackson came in later. His first offer was to Robert La Follette. That was very interesting.
I never knew that.
No, it's written up, and he offered it to Robert La Follette, and La Follette turned it down. He wanted to have an important American, and he was very unhappy that the United States gave him an obscure figure as Assistant Secretary General, Jack Hudson.
Yes.
Jack Hudson from agriculture, and Feller was more prominent in the United States and was much closer, very close, personally to Dean Acheson, so he had more standing with Lee than Jack Hudson did, but still he wanted, and Feller also favored having an important political person. And La Follette was his choice, interestingly, because La Follette was a isolationist, and he wanted it for a while, and then he backed down. I don't really know why he did that. Jacko came in later. He wasn't called deputy, and he was for coordination. I can't remember that, sure. But I remember the anger of the other assistant secretaries general, especially Logier and some of the others who felt that Jackson was an inappropriate choice and would try to boss them around. And I remember Jackson making a speech for a team spirit, and we all got something like that, a real pep talk, and Logier muttering, "Les Nazis aussi," and something, "The Nazis also had team spirit," he was muttering in French. And so there was that never worked out as a deputy, and he ran into difficulties with Trigger over various things. But Lee was a difficult person. He was very impulsive, and he reacted. On the other hand, he, in some ways, he had good instincts, and I think that his record is not a very bad one. It's a tolerable one, and he was symbolically he fit the figure of the appropriate Scandinavian leader at the time.
Well, I want to ask you the same question now about the third Secretary General you worked for, of course, that's Utant. Mm-hmm. What do you think was his greatest strength?
Well, Utant, first of all, was more in tune with what had become by that time the majority membership, the Third World. He felt their demands, was responsive to their demands, and symbolically coming from that world, he represented them. And I think his strength was, first of all, he had a much better sense of publicity, I believe. You're the expert in that, than either Hammarskjöld or Lee. I think Utant was used to turning out publicity. I remember he told me
he had been a journalist at one time.
Not only that, he told me he used to write, there were 28 papers in Rangoon. Okay. Unbelievable. And when he was in the government as a press officer, information officer, he used to write, and he told me this without any sense of shame, that he used to write editorials for several of the Rangoon papers as a government man. But he had a sense of getting in these statements and time and a feeling for that, which Hammarskjöld was torn about any publicity. He never really was comfortable, and he was very two-sided in that way. Now, Utant had no hang-ups at all. I mean, he wanted to speak up, and he spoke up. And then he was, you might say he was courageous in the sense that he, I guess you could say that, he took stands, which the others had taken, but in a way, when he criticized the United States in Vietnam, some of this might have been due to personal umbrage, feelings of injury because the U.S. had not consulted him, and he may have been too precipitate in making those statements. I'm not sure in the long run, and it's a hard question, as to whether by his speaking out against the United States on Vietnam, he harmed his relation and his position or not. At the time, I sympathized with his position, and I thought
he certainly was not popular with Dean Rusk.
It was not popular with the United States, and he lost their confidence during that period.
What would you say was his greatest weakness?